you very much, Peter, for that very generous introduction. And it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation to talk to you today about the resources boom. This event, this rise in the price of natural resources with which our country is very strongly endowed, is one of the largest such events in our history. We've had quite a bit to say about it in the RBA, and actually I'm not going to say anything today that's new. I'll just touch on some of the other things that we've said in the past. And here's the relevant disclaimer for everyone listening. I'm not here to convey any messages about monetary policy, having covered those matters in some detail just 2 weeks ago with the House Economics Committee. I'd like to structure my remarks really about one chart, which I'm going to try to get up here in a moment, which you've all seen elsewhere by now, and around four questions. The questions are, what do we know from the history of previous booms? And there have been a number. Secondly, what do we know about this one? Thirdly, what don't we know? And then finally, how should our knowledge and the limits to our knowledge condition the way we respond as a country to these events? So what do we know about previous booms? There it is. Well, this chart, which is originally from a research paper about 5 years ago by a couple of our staff, at that time that line didn't go up quite so far as it does now, and it was also used in an address that I gave a few months back to CEDA here in Melbourne. And I've noticed it being used by others more widely recently because of the striking story that it tells. It's the terms of trade since 1870 for Australia, and there's an annual series and then a five-year moving average of that data. So one thing we know pretty quickly just looking at this is that large swings in prices for agricultural and resource commodities, which have resulted in big variations in Australia's terms of trade, have been a recurring feature of our experience ever since we've been a producer of these types of commodities. There have been a number of big booms. They've all ended so far. And the really high peaks were quite temporary, usually just one or two of these annual observations before things started to reverse, as in the case, say, in the mid-1920s or the early 50s. Periods of fairly high terms of trade did last for some years, as shown by the five-year moving average here. But in every episode so far, they've been followed by a return to trend or even a fall well below trend. So we know that. We also know that these swings were quite disruptive for the macro economy. My colleague Rick Battaglino, in a speech that, as it turns out, was given a year ago today, did an analysis, quite a well-researched analysis, of five mining boom episodes going back over 200 years. It's well worth a look, that talk. Let me reprise four key observations that he made in that speech. Firstly, global developments have always played a key part in driving these booms and busts. Changes to the availability of capital or the emergence of large, low-income countries with rapid growth prospects, so think about Japan post-World War II or China in recent years, these things have often affected the relative price of minerals and energy. Secondly, these booms were always expansionary for the Australian economy. Thirdly, related to that, they usually pushed up inflation. The exception to that maybe was in the 1890s, early in that decade when other things were going wrong. But the fourth observation is that the role of the exchange rate one way or another, is critical in handling these episodes. And the current episode, in fact, stands out from the others because in most of the previous episodes, we were seeking to deal with these booms with the exchange rate either heavily managed or, in fact, not able to move at all. That not only severely compromised the conduct of monetary policy, but it also muted the relative price signals that the economy needed to receive. So, in short, these episodes were major externally generated shocks, which proved very disruptive, not least because the country's macroeconomic policy framework wasn't well set up to deal with the event. The high terms of trade reached on some occasions weren't permanent, though they did stick around long enough to be quite disruptive to economic conditions. So that's my summation of what we know from history. What then do we know about this boom? Well, the main thing we know is that it's very large, as you can see here. It's being driven by a big increase in demand for a range of commodities, and that will increase substantially further over the next several years. We're shipping about 300 million tonnes a year of coal, or at least we were until the recent floods in Queensland, which have led to some lost production. Capacity to export liquefied natural gas is now 20 million tonnes a year, up from half of that 6 years ago. And that would probably increase to 50 million tonnes over the next 5 years and possibly higher than that later on. This rise in demand for resources and energy has been driven in large part by the rapid growth of key emerging countries like China and India. Over the past decade, per capita GDP growth in India has been over 6%, in China almost 10%. The number of people living in cities in those two countries, especially China, has gone up 250 million. So what they've had to do is to expand or create cities to house the 10 times the population of Australia in 10 years, or to put it another way, to house the combined populations of France, Germany and Japan in that period. Steel production has doubled in India over that decade. It's more than quintupled in China. So these are very big increases. Thus far, the demand for resources has stretched the capacity of suppliers, and so prices for key raw materials have been driven upwards. And as a result, as you can see, Australia's terms of trade have risen sharply. They're about 65% higher than the 20th century average. They're 85% above what they would be if they were on that downwardly sloping trend line. That's an estimated trend over the 20th century. Even assuming that the terms of trade soon peak and start to go down, which we do assume, on a five-year moving average basis, our terms of trade are the highest since Federation by quite a margin, as you can see there. At this level, the terms of trade at this level and all other things equal, Australia's nominal GDP is about 13% higher than it would be if the terms of trade were at the 20th century average. So that's a lot of extra income. Now, of course, we don't own all that income. Australia has very substantial foreign ownership of the resource sector. It's substantial in iron ore, it's probably bigger in coal, and it's very large in gas. So we don't own all that income, but probably roughly half, we would say, of that additional 13% of GDP accrues to Australians one way or another. We also know that a large expansion in the resource sector's capacity to supply these commodities is being planned. Already, mining sector capital investment as a share of GDP has risen from an average of about 2% over the past 25 years to around 4% now. That's higher than the peaks of the late 60s or the late 70s, early 80s booms. Given the scale of additional investment plans that have been mooted, many of which are likely to proceed, resource sector investment could rise by another 1 to 2% of GDP over the next couple of years. If that occurs, that will be the largest capital build-up in the Australian resources sector in our modern history. Now, again, a significant proportion of that physical investment is going to be imported. Nonetheless, there will be very substantial domestic spend. A further thing we know about the boom, and Peter alluded to this, is that it's associated with a much higher level of the exchange rate than we've been accustomed to seeing in the 25 years that it's been floating. If you go back in history, before that, actually, the exchange rate's been considerably higher than this plenty of times, but certainly for the floating era, it's at a very high level now. It's about 25% above the floating era average in trade-weighted terms. The striking relationship between the so-called real exchange rate, the effective exchange rate adjusted for price level differentials, and the terms of trade, which we've seen for many years in history, still seems broadly to be in place. It's true, of course, that interest rates also affect the exchange rate, and even though many of our market rates at the short end are in fact lower than medium-term averages, like the cash rate or the 90-day bill rate, the fact that interest rates in the major financial centres are close to zero over an extended period means that interest differentials have strongly favoured the Australian dollar. That's not the only thing at work. The other thing that's at work, which I think is powerful, is the expectation that the rate of return on real capital, say in mining, for example, in Australia is going to be high, and that will be a prominent driver of capital flows. We know that changes in the real exchange rate are part of the textbook response to shifts in the terms of trade. In past episodes, where movements in the nominal exchange rate couldn't occur, a range of other prices in the economy had to adjust to bring about this real exchange rate shift. Arguably, and I would argue, that's a much more disruptive way, ultimately, of adjusting to the shock. On this occasion, the nominal exchange rate has responded strongly, so that's helping to offset the expansionary income effects that we get from the terms of trade. It helps spill demand abroad, and it gives price signals to the production sector for labour and capital to move to areas of higher return. In other words, that is, firms outside of the resource sector who are trade exposed are facing significant pressure for adjustment. But actually, they're going to face that anyway in the face of this shock, one way or another. So that's what we know. What don't we know? Well, the main thing we don't know is how long this is going to go on and how long it will the terms of trade will stay high. And that matters a lot. If it's only temporary, if the rise in income, which is very substantial, is only temporary, then we really shouldn't respond to that with an increase in national consumption. It would probably be better in that case to allow the higher income to flow into a higher stock of savings, which you've then got to help consumption through periods of lower terms of trade, which will come one day out there somewhere. Likewise, it wouldn't make sense to invest a lot in resource sectors, resource industries, which could only be profitable at very, very high prices in case those prices decline. And the economic restructuring that we're going to face, at least to some extent, and which of course brings costs, well, you don't want to bear too many of those costs if it turns out that a few years later you have to bear new costs to restructure back in the other direction. So if the the boom is just temporary, there are certain responses that we don't want to have very much. On the other hand, if the change is going to be persistent, if it really is different this time, then real national income is going to be higher permanently. We're going to look forward to substantially higher standards of living into the indefinite future in that scenario. In that world, we're going to have a great deal of structural adjustment in the economy. That's already starting, but if relative prices stay where they are now, there's a lot more of that to come. You wouldn't want to stop that. You couldn't stop it, actually, but you wouldn't want to in the scenario where the terms of trade gain is permanent. Well, we know that previous peaks in the terms of trade were short-lived. In this one, well, the fact that you can draw a five-year average like that itself kind of says that it's starting to look like it's persisting longer this time than in other occasions. Well, you could interpret it that two ways. Maybe that says it's about to collapse because it's already been here for a while. Maybe it says that this boom isn't like the others and much of the increase is going to be permanent. In favour of that view, I think one could point out that if China and India maintain their recent rates of catch-up to the levels of productivity and living standards in the Western advanced countries, and if they follow the same path of steel intensity of production and energy intensity of production that other countries have in the past, then a strong pace of increase in demand for resources and energy probably will continue for quite a while yet. On the other hand, of course, there is a supply response coming. Resource companies here, and not only in Australia, are racing to take advantage of these high prices by bringing on new capacity. Is that increase in supply going to be just enough to meet the demand? Is it going to be too little? Is it going to be too much? Well, we don't know. An additional complicating factor, it seems to me, also could be that if there are serious attempts at reducing CO2 emissions at some point, that's going to change the outlook here in various ways. And moreover, the simple lesson of history that in all past experiences, booms don't go on indefinitely. Obviously, we can't ignore that. Well, at this stage, the assumption that our staff are making is the terms of trade start to fall in the latter part of the forecast horizon. I might add that that assumption has been made for a couple of years now. It's been wrong so far. In fact, the terms of trade have kept rising. But at this point, we are making that assumption. As you can see at the end, that it starts. That assumption, I think, is probably a bit more pessimistic than many of the market forecasts for the relevant commodity price. But even under that assumption, on a five-year basis and at the end of this horizon, the terms of trade are still very high by historical standards. But any forecast here, any assumption, frankly, is subject to a very large margin of uncertainty. We just don't know what's going to happen. We know something big has been occurring for some time, but we simply cannot know how this will turn out in the medium term. So how do we respond to that? To come to the final question. Just to recap what we know that previous booms were big events, they were disruptive. We know they all ended, with the terms of trade more or less going back to trend. We know that the current boom looks bigger than anything else we've seen in 100 years, at least measured on the terms of trade metric. And we know that compared to previous episodes, the exchange rate is playing its role as a shock absorber, helping the economy adapt to this in a way that it couldn't do in the past. We do not know what the terms of trade will do in the future. It seems to me it would be extreme, really, to assume that the rise of China and India is a flash in the pan that's going to go away. I don't think that's so. But equally, it would be imprudent, I think, not to allow for a reasonably noticeable decline in prices of these commodities, even if only to still pretty attractive levels. It would
truth is, we're only going to learn gradually
what the environment looks like.
So how do we handle that uncertainty? Well, I would offer a few simple messages, and there's nothing terribly profound here. And most of this I've said before. But the first thing is, obviously, it seems to me obvious, we shouldn't assume that the recent pace of national income growth is a good estimate of its likely permanent pace. We should allow a good chunk of the current rapid growth in national income to flow into saving. It's easy later to consume some of that income if the income gains do turn out to be permanent. It's much harder to wind back absorption that has run up in anticipation of income gains that then don't persist or even arrive. So I'm arguing for a precautionary approach. As it turns out, it seems to me that, in fact, is what's happening by and large. Households are saving considerably more than they have for quite a few years, and we read every day about the so-called cautious consumer. Firms are consolidating balance sheet, by and large corporate leverage is declining, and governments most recently have recommitted to earlier stated fiscal intentions. So we do have at least a certain degree of precautionary behaviour, at least at the moment. Second observation is there's going to be a non-trivial degree of structural change in the economy because we've had a very big change in relative prices. That's already beginning, but if relative prices look anything like this for a persistent period, then there's going to be more of that change. Because we can't really know where relative prices are going to settle, we don't know whether the amount of structural change we will see might turn out to be more than needed or not. Some of it might need to be reversed at some point. But the optimal amount of structural change isn't going to be none at all. And so it seems to me that in thinking about a response to this, we shouldn't be seeking to prevent that change. We ought to be making it as little, we ought to be trying to have it cost as little as possible. And in general, that's going to mean preserving flexibility and supporting adaptation to change rather than resistance to it. Thirdly, surely productivity is going to come back into focus, especially in sectors that are exposed to the rise in the exchange rate. When you think about those sectors, their prices are going to be squeezed by a high exchange rate, and their costs might well be under upward pressure as the resource sector So it's hard to see how retaining viability in these sectors is can avoid seeking much more substantial gains in productivity than we seem to have been seeing across the economy in recent years. I think that's an important point. And then finally, if we are to face structural adjustments, it's infinitely preferable to be doing that in an environment in which overall national income is growing quickly. If nothing else, it means that the gainers can compensate the losers more easily. Think about the extent of structural adjustment that's needed in a whole bunch of other countries at the moment who are doing it in against a backdrop of weakness. Well, I think many of them would prefer to have our issues than the ones they in fact face themselves. Let me then conclude. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, the rise in Australia's terms of trade over the past 5 years is the biggest such event in a very long time. It reflects very powerful forces in the global economy to which our country is more favourably exposed than most others. It presents opportunities and it also presents challenges. With a large boost to income, we need to think about the balance between saving and spending because we don't know what the permanent level of the terms of trade is going to be. I argue for erring on the side of saving, and by and large, so far, I think that's more or less what is happening.
With the large change in relative prices, we should also expect to see significant structural change in the economy. A careful, thoughtful response to that is going to be needed, and I imagine that as the day goes on here today, you're going to spend a good deal of time talking about just that. And with that, I wish you well in your deliberations, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Glenn. Governor has kindly agreed to take questions, so I see Michael Stockbridge's hand going immediately. So,
fire away, Michael.
Microphone, yes.
Governor,
I could have muted the press there effectively, couldn't I?
Governor, you've talked about the long-term demand from China and India. Pushing up the term to trade and the question of the medium-run supply response globally is the main factors driving the term to trade. And I wonder if you could touch on maybe the shorter and medium-term pressures that might produce volatility in the term to trade amid a longer-run China-India story. For example, right now we see the US involved in major military operations offshore. They're gone through a nasty recession, expanding monetary policy quite aggressively. That's sweeping across the Pacific and pushing up asset prices in developing economies in East Asia, getting inflationary pressures. You've seen a sharp rise in commodity prices over the summer, which has extended into food prices. Right. That seems to have sparked social unrest through North Africa. You're seeing oil prices rise over $100. It's looking a little bit like the early 70s in some ways. How, and you mentioned this in the monetary policy statement, how worried are you by the instability it's producing rising global commodity price inflation in terms of managing the boom over the next few years?
I think it's certainly true that the conjunction of free money in the G3 countries and the robust growth we're seeing in Asia, not just in Asia, also in Latin America, similar issues there. So you do get these capital flows. Various countries are responding to that in differing ways. There's been some exchange rate appreciation in some cases, but use of capital controls has also been more prominent in a number of those cases. So people are trying to adjust to these pressures. I think on the whole, though, that financial conditions in much of the Asian region are fairly expansionary. They have been, and that probably remains so. We presumably will see those conditions tighten up over the year. China is tightening their policies, I think, probably with a little more determination maybe now than we saw last year, which means I think we should expect to see China begin to slow down this year. And, of course, we all have a big stake in them managing that process as smoothly as possible. So that's going to be, I think, a cyclical event overlaid on top of this longer run structural adjustment that probably has quite some years to go. As far as food prices go, there are structural things at work here too, because as hundreds of millions of people in the emerging world get more income, the shifts in the nature of their diet and so on has an impact on the price of grains, and we need probably better supply responses for those kinds of things in order to contain these pressures. It isn't just going to be about macroeconomic policy. So I think all these things are in the mix. And it's a complex situation, and as you point out, food prices in particular in countries where food's a big part of the cost of living, it's a very sensitive topic, so it's important it be handled very carefully. Not sure I can do much better than that on a rather broad question.
Thank you.
Ed Chan.
So, Ed Chan, is the next question, and then one here.
And it seems to me that why the terms of trade fallback's quite important. I mean, you can have a temporary spike in your terms of trade due to a supply disruption or a temporary boost in demand, but if we're in a situation where demand's growing rapidly for a sustained period and we increase supply and eventually supply catches up, terms of trade may fall back, but we can potentially win market share and end up with higher income even though the terms of trade fall. And that seems to me much more likely to be the case this time around than it has been in the past. That is, unless you're very pessimistic about China and think demand's going to collapse, we're in a situation where if we respond in the correct way, we can actually have a permanent rise in our income, even if the terms of trade
I think I'd broadly agree with that. I think if the prices come back because the supply rises quickly enough to keep up with the demand that keeps proceeding pretty quickly, we can still do well by shifting more of our productive sector into that that line of things, even at prices not quite as high as today. So I agree with that. There are other issues that come, of course, with, you know, if you think about an economy much more dominated by resources, and China, even if you think they've got a long-run growth trajectory, which I do, but they still have a business cycle, and we will feel that more than we used to. And if more and more of the economy is geared to that, then we need to be thinking about stabilisation through the cycle. But generally speaking, I probably agree with your thesis there, I think.
Now, there was another question here. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Alex English from Victoria University's Centre for Strategic Economic Studies. Just to bring it back to the regional level, I was just wondering how successful you think we've been in tackling that structural adjustment requirements, as well as some of the pressures for productivity increases against the risks that you say will be in there in the medium to long term, for example, the role of innovation or responding to, say, climate.
That seems like a pretty big question too. I'm not sure how to come at answering it. I think, on the one hand, the forces we're talking about will probably have significant impacts that differ by regions within the country. I take that's what you're talking about. I mean, the evidence to date is, frankly, that on the best sort of high-level data that we can get, the differences in performance across the states or across the regions is not actually that large thus far. I mean, there are differences. Ironically enough, Victoria is leading the charge among the states at the moment, even though the mining's not mostly here. Queensland is lagging, and then everybody else is kind of clustered in the middle. When you look at the data where we have the greatest breakdown by region would probably be the unemployment rate across 70 statistical regions, and only one or two of those is in double digits. The vast bulk of them are under 6%, and a lot of them under 5, and plenty under 4, actually. So the differences up to this point in time are not actually that marked. They probably will get more apparent over the years ahead. So I suppose my argument would be, in Australia, you've got fiscal transfers, you've got, you know, a degree of labour mobility and so on. We're as well equipped as any nation or region to cope with these things by having resource flow flexibility. But the test, I guess, will get greater as we go into this if we do go into a long period of a very high real price of commodities. So the trick is going to be to keep that capacity for flexible adjustment.
Shane Wright from the West Australian. Glenn, where you mentioned in your speech that gainers need to compensate, will need to compensate losers. Is there a role for that to be a resource rent tax of some sort? And do you see that there needs to be more space at the fiscal level in terms of saving?
Well, Shane, I'm not going to buy into the resource rent tax. I create enough controversy with my day job, so I'm not going to moonlight as a tax sort of guy. There's a lot on the public record out of Canberra about those issues, and I can't possibly do much justice to it, I think, off the cuff. On the fiscal saving, I think there is an argument that, and I put this was in the talk I gave to CEDA late last year. If you think about this notion that we might be more plugged into a high variability path with a bigger resource sector, and you think about how you want to manage stabilisation policy, I think there probably is an argument for saying that if that's the world you're in, you allow the budget balance to swing by more than we've been accustomed to doing in recent years. Terribly controversial idea. Whether that'll turn out to be the case and whether we are indeed in that world, of course, with a highly cyclical resource sector, we don't know yet. It's just a factor to think about. One at the back, Peter.
We'll get back and speak about this in 3 years' time. Might it be better if, because however long this boom lasts, it certainly looks like lasting a while on the basis of the graph and what we know. Might it be better if we now set up some kind of macro stabilisation fund where resource income was locked away? Saving just happens to be high right now, but you're saying it needs to be high. I'm wondering whether we should.
Well, I'm saying it's rational for it to be high, given a degree of uncertainty about the longer run future. And as it turns out, whether it's for that reason or some other reason, people are considerably more cautious now than they've been in the past. Whether it's a good idea for there to be a stabilisation fund, well, and that's distinct, let's be clear, from the normal notion of a sovereign wealth fund where the money goes in but doesn't come out, except in the very long run future. Stabilisation funds are, it goes in but then it comes out when the cycle turns down, so that's set up differently. Whether that's a good idea or not, I'm not sure, but I guess my view would be that that's an option worth thinking about, that's all. If your starting presumption is we've got a much bigger resource sector but still a cycle, and therefore we want to think about ways in which the economy can be cushioned from the big swings. If you don't think that, then there's no case for stabilisation policy fund at all. So it depends on what presumption you're starting with.
You've said you're a cautious person.
Yeah, well, I'm a cautious enough person not to venture down this track any further today, I think.
So
the hairs are already running, I'm sure.
We've time for one more question, and Chancellor George Pappas has that honour. And we've got a microphone on its way.
Thank you, and firstly, thank you for the very able way in which you've set the framework for the rest of the conference. But I was interested in your thoughts about our external trade balance, and the fact that it seems as if, notwithstanding the record terms of trade, a deficit persists. Is that an issue for concern, or should we not worry too much about it?
Well, the trade balance actually in surplus at the moment. The current account position would still be in deficit, though considerably smaller deficit than we've tended to get used to. Here's how I normally answer the question about the current account. In 1980, at 22 years of age, I went for a job interview at the Reserve Bank, and they didn't actually ask me about the current account, but had they asked the question, do you think Australia could sustain a current account deficit of 4.5% of GDP for 30 years? This is after a 30-year history of 2 or 3%. Had I answered yes, I wouldn't have been employed, I'm pretty sure. But in fact, that is what we've sustained. So when you think through that, you know, we used to fret about the current account a great deal, in the 80s particularly. We did everything that people told us to do that would fix it, and basically the current account deficit more or less was completely invariant to those things. The budget went to surplus, but private saving fell. We did a whole bunch of microeconomic reforms which were great for productivity, but actually that can induce even more capital flow. So, you know, it's a complex area. I suppose my simple take is the thing that matters most is what did you do with the capital that came in? Did you use it sensibly? Because if you did, you're probably going to be able to, A, service the obligations, and B, retain the confidence of the foreign investors. If you didn't use it wisely, you've got a problem. But even if the capital came from onshore and you don't use it wisely, you're in a bad place. So the key thing is to use the capital sensibly, and if we do that, then we'll probably manage on the external side, I think.
Thanks, Glenn. Okay. So that means we've come to an end of this session, and I'd like to join with the Chancellor in thanking Governor of the Reserve Bank, Glenn Stevens, for his excellent speech, which really has set the conference off to a tremendous start, and for his typically razor-sharp answering of the questions, which was a terrific part of the session as well. So perhaps you can all join with me in thanking the Governor. So we've probably got 30 seconds or so for you to shuffle around the seats as we get ready for the next session. Thank you. 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 The next session. Thank you.